So at the beginning of his book, Gang Leader for a Day, Sudhir Venkatesh writes about waking up in a crack den surrounded by junkies and drug dealers. He writes, quote, "The activities of the previous night, smoking crack, drinking, having sex, vomiting, had peaked at around 2 a.m. By then, the unconscious people outnumbered the conscious ones, and among the conscious, few still had the cash to buy another hit of crack cocaine. That's when the Black Kings saw diminishing prospects for sales and closed up shop for the night." It sounds to many like a nightmare, but for Sudhir, it was just another day of research. As a sociology student in Chicago, he made unlikely friends with one of the most violent gangs in the city at the time, the Black Kings. And over the course of 7 years, he divided his time between the white, leafy suburb of Hyde Park and one of the country's largest public housing projects, Robert Taylor. His book, Gang Leader for a Day, is the story of that experience. And Sudhir Venkatesh joins me now in the studio. Thanks very much for waking up this morning.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
I appreciate it. You went to the projects as a student about to embark on this research project with a survey in your hand with a question on it, a provocative question: what does it mean to be black and poor? What was the response from the people you asked this question to?
Probably not something I can say on NPR. I was a nerdy sociologist who gave them five choices, asking them, how does it feel to be black and poor? And they said, you can't ask questions like these. You have to come and hang out with people if you really want to know what it's like. And they actually kept me there for about 24 hours because they actually didn't believe that anyone would be stupid enough to ask questions like this. And they thought I was a street gang member from a Mexican gang. They didn't know what I was. And so when they let me go, I came back, and I stayed for 7 years. And the book is a product of that experience.
Describe to people what the scene was like in Chicago at the time when you started this project. How prevalent were the gangs? What was their influence?
So just to set the context, we're talking about communities like the Robert Taylor projects, which are about 40,000, 30,000 to 40,000 people. 97% of them are not working, and families living off $10,000 per year. So these are places where there's no government, really. So the street gangs are the police force. They're the philanthropists. They're who residents turn to. So it's a place that residents were, in some sense, had no other choice but to have this very complicated relationship with the street gang, that they're subject to their violence, but they have to live in these communities. And this book is really about the leader of one of these gangs.
His name is JT. You met him. You became close friends with him. This man is someone who went to college.
Yeah, the first words he uttered that were uttered from his mouth took me by storm when he told me, I have a college degree. I couldn't believe that this guy actually, and his story is interesting. He worked in corporate America in the late 1980s, and he figured that an African-American couldn't get ahead in corporate America. And he became despondent, and he came back to his projects to run a crack-dealing street gang because he was so pessimistic.
This, as you allude to, this gang was more than a drug-running criminal operation. They also served as a community support group in many ways. They created their own economy, power structure, even a justice system that you actually took part in at one point. Can you explain what happened when you found yourself getting immersed in this militia government?
Yeah, that's a great way of saying it. It's an economy and a separate justice system. So when you can't rely on the government, you know, I can take people to small claims court. These folks have to police themselves. So it's this underground economy, and when something goes wrong, they have to punish people who don't pay, for example, or they ask the gang to find the people that don't pay. And there was this one incident. It was actually about domestic abuse, but the same kind of justice, where I was in a stairwell, and the street gang and some squatters found a person who had raped and assaulted a young woman, and they were beating them up. And one of the squatters was being choked, and he was going to pass out. Perhaps even die. And I was standing there, and I was the only one who saw this. And so I was no longer the fly on the wall. I actually just kicked the person until he let the squatter go and got the chokehold off. I was not expecting to become involved, but you can't sit there and not do anything.
And, I mean, some frightening stuff happened to you during these 7 years. I mean, you were threatened. People pulled weapons on you. Why did you keep coming back? What did you have to know before you could leave this research?
I think every time I thought I had enough, another door opened. So just when I thought I understood how the street gang ran its economy, I had to listen and figure out why the residents would even tolerate a gang like this. When it was one neighborhood, then I wanted to know about the city as a whole. Then I realized that the gang has this incredible hold on the poor neighborhoods. And then I wondered, well, what do the police do? So I started befriending police. And I think, unlike journalists who may get, a day, a week, a month on a story, I had 7 years and I took advantage of it. I just wanted to go deeper and deeper and deeper.
At one point, JT does turn to you and offers you this, what he calls, opportunity of a lifetime. Can you tell us what happened?
He offered me several opportunities of a lifetime. The one that I maybe you're thinking of is when I got to step in his shoes and actually hang out with him for 24 hours and watch how he made decisions and ran his organization. And that opened my eyes up to a side of the underground economy I really hadn't seen before, which is just the ruthless violence. You know, two of his drug sellers had an argument, and he would have to figure out who was lying, who stole the drugs from him, and beat the living daylights out of them. So any romantic view I had about this, once I walked next to him, were quickly dispelled just by watching the violence.
Which you did have. You write about how it was kind of watching a movie unfold before your eyes. And it's pretty cool to hang out with a really important gang leader. And those eventually, how did your perspective on this all change at the end of 7 years?
I think the hardest thing for me in writing this book was not to romanticize these folks and not to just give a one-sided portrait of what they were like. And the fact is that they were extremely violent. And as I kept getting deeper and deeper and deeper, I had to balance my own ethical decisions about getting this close and watching violence, like a war reporter, frankly, and trying to do something about it. And so I would see drive-by shootings and beatings and things like that. And a lot of what this book is about is my own attempt to wrestle with getting caught in the middle and figuring out what to do. And I stumble all along the way.
What did you come away with? How did living this life, because you were really living with them, how did it change how you do your work and how you view sociology, this academic kind of pursuit?
So the kind of sociology I do, where I move in with families in poor communities, used to be exactly what sociologists did 100 years ago, but it's totally gone out of fashion. You know, we're used to sociologists doing surveys and things like that, census polls. I think this is what you have to do. I'm not saying I want everyone to go out and live with a street gang, but I do think there's a value of getting really, really close to people and stepping in their shoes just to understand what life is like from their side.
Real quickly, did JT or any other of the gang members read your book?
I have a book. I'm going to hopefully give it to JT, and it says, "Be careful of what you wish for, because it just might come true." He thought I was his biographer, so, you know, here it is.
Thank you so much, Sudhir Venkatesh, author of Gang Leader for a Day. Thanks for coming by the
BPP. Thanks for having me. I appreciate
it. And that is it for the BPP. We're always online at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Rachel Martin here in New York City, BPP World Headquarters.
And I'm Allison Stewart. We've been at KCPW. They have been tremendous hosts. Thanks to Brian Schott and everybody who's made this so possible. And Rachel, I'm going to make you a little jealous. I'm about to have a little brunch with some BPP listeners who have come to the station.
Oh, that's very
hang
cool.
Out. Have a cup of joe.
Tell them thank you from New York.
I will tell them a big thank you from New York. And hey, do check out our blog. We're going to have more reports from Sundance, some more video diaries, interviews with filmmakers, musical performances. We'll keep it going all week as long as the festival goes. I'm Allison Stewart signing off. See you, Rachel. See you, everybody.